good morning, everyone. For technical problem, a person from Australia is supposed to join by video conference, but for technical reason, we cannot connect, so we will invite him by telephone conference. So in the meantime, that Hiromi is connecting by telephone, let's start the webcasting and also around the table for contributor framework. I think Australian people will join in due course. Then please start. Are you sure you want to start? Okay, yes.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Conceptual Framework Roundtable in Tokyo.
Good morning, everybody. This is the Conceptual Framework Roundtable in Tokyo. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time and I appreciate your attendance. I'm quite happy to have a conceptual framework roundtable in the Asia-Oceania office with such a gorgeous members. Well, ISD published discussion paper in July and the comment period will end 14th of January next year. So we have a couple of months for the end of the comment period. And I think this is a very good timing to see each other and exchange opinions. Actually, we already had round table in London, Toronto, São Paulo, and Tokyo is the last round table. So our discussion paper covers almost everything of conceptual framework. So this is very wide. Today, we concentrate on three topics, that is measurement and profit or loss and OCI. And the third one is asset and liability definition, recognition and derecognition. We are going to make a discussion based on the paper provided. And if we have time, then we would like to cover other areas. By the way, this meeting will be held all in English, but we are making a simultaneous translation for the sake of audience. So please be careful not to be too fast. And this is a 3-hour session, but I do not have any plan to take an official break. So if you would like to take your toiletry break, please do so at your own time. Okay, before we get started, we would like to have a self-introduction now. So I'm Takuchi, ISD board member.
Hi, I'm Christy Robinson. I'm a technical principal at the ISD and one of the staff members who's been working on the conceptual framework. And I primarily dealt with disclosure and presentation and profit and loss and OCI.
Hi, I'm Ryuichi Nagano from JICD.
Hi, I'm Takafumi Oseko from Deutsche Tomat.
I'm Rieko Hiano from Price Waterhouse.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Dealing from the Malaysian Accounting Standards Board.
Good morning, Shilin from the Ministry of Finance in China.
Hello, my name is Yu Chen from China.
Okay, so this is a very early stage of the project, and therefore we would like to listen to your voice, very frank opinion. After having a re-deliberation, perhaps we need to narrow down the area of the discussion. However, we can discuss everything now. So I welcome your opinion today.
So, you kick off from Christy, please.
So the topic we'll talk about first is measurement, and I will refer to Agenda Paper 1, which you should have in front of you. And the purpose of this paper and this part of the roundtable is to discuss your reactions to Section 6 of the discussion paper on measurement. And the first subject we want to talk about is the objective of measurement. And the discussion paper says that the objective of measurement is to contribute to the faithful representation of relevant information about the resources of the entity, claims against the entity, and changes in resources and claims, and how efficiently and effectively the entity's management and governing board have discharged their responsibilities to use the entity's resources. So the first question, which is discussion question one, is do you think the conceptual framework should include an overall measurement objective? And do you agree with the measurement objective proposed in the conceptual framework? So with that introduction, I'd like to open it up for discussion.
Does anybody have any opinion about the measurement? Yes, please, Feeling.
Thank you, sir. We agree there should be an objective for measurement, but we believe the objective of measurement should be a subset of the objective for financial reporting, and there should not be an overlapping between the objective of measurement and the objective of financial reporting. So perhaps one suggestion is the objective of measurement should lay out the process in determining the in determining how the measurement basis of a selected item is being arrived at.
Does anybody have any other opinion? Yes, you can.
Thank you. In our opinion, the objective of measurement consists of two aspects. One is reflects the decision usefulness from the for the users. Another one reflects the stewardship from management. We think that ISB should provide more guidance or requirements for us to make decisions on how to balance these two objectives in practice. Because in practice, sometimes from the perspective of user and from the perspective from management, maybe they will make different decisions on the management basis. So how to balance these two objectives, this is the first point. Another one, we think the objective of measurement should coordinate with the objective of financial reporting. But we found that the objective of financial reporting only refers to the decision usefulness for users. So our suggestion would be that could you please reintroduce stewardship in the objective of finance for of the financial reporting.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is one of the most contentious issues, whether or not we should retrieve stewardship in our conceptual framework. And I think if we have time, we would like to discuss stewardship issue later. This is in the section 9. However, nevertheless, what you said about the balancing the two objectives is the one of the most difficult issues which we should achieve. So on this point, if you have any comments?
Just to say that the objective of measurement which we've articulated here does drive off those two objectives, and we can go into it a bit more detail when we talk about stewardship, perhaps when we talk about chapters 1 and 3, if we get to that, is that we see that discussion about how efficiently and effectively the entity's management and governing board have used the entity's resources is reflecting that stewardship notion, and that's already embedded in the objective chapter, so I think it's OB4, I'd have to have a look at it, but it's already embodied in that objective financial reporting. You sort of have to go through a couple of paragraphs to get there, but we do think it is already embedded in there. What we have tried to do in the discussion paper, and as you can see here in the measurement objective, we tried to bring that out and be clearer that that still exists, and that's why we tried to specify it here. And I think you'll see something similar in when we talk about disclosures as well, that that same sort of bringing out that idea, which is already embedded in the objective but is being tried to be brought out in other parts of the discussion paper.
Thank you. I have two comments, and the first comment relates to Chen-Yu's point on stewardship. In the objective section, two purposes are presented: helping investors' investment decisions and help stewardship assessment. And I think it's a great improvement that two objectives are referred to. But I think the current presentation may give an impression that the ISB puts priority on investment decision support to stewardship. And I suppose most of the time the two objectives go hand in hand: successful presentation, relevant information. But in the case of two contradictory each other in rare cases, I think if this presentation implies the ISB always use investment decision purpose first, and in the case of conflict, deny stewardship perspective, I think it's not a proper kind of setting of objectives. And having two purposes and reconciling in each cases of conflict would be complicated task. But if you say you prioritize investment decision support first, always, things would look much simpler and consistent and beautiful. But I suppose in real decision making of a standard setting, you need to consider both aspects and make a comparison and a decision. So I would rather prefer to see no prioritization between the two and putting two things together. And my second comment is somewhat related to the first point, and it relates to page 6 of the this paper. In section 8 of paragraph 13, it is stated that the measurement method gonna affect both profit and loss and OCI and financial position statement. And in the decision to switch measurement approach to use should be made not just thinking about financial statements, but the impact on profit and loss statement and OCI as well. I think this is a very important statement, and this is characterized as one other consideration, but I believe this can be promoted to one of the fundamental objective parts of the
system. Okay, and I think the way it's been described here as an other consideration is not that we think it's something of lesser priority. I think the way the chapter in the discussion paper is, or the section in the discussion paper is worded, it does flow as part of the discussion there. So I don't take in too much heart the way that we've structured it in this paper. That's more to aid discussion rather than the way that we've had not implying a priority of that point, because I think that was actually a preliminary view of the board, so it was something that did actually I think have that along with sort of the two measurement basis which we'll talk about, multiple measurement basis which we'll talk about, is a significant change, and it also leads to the second topic that we're going to discuss today about profit and loss and OCI.
Okay. Just a moment. I just want to make sure.
Did you connect?
Yes, we're connecting to.
Right. Hello. Can you hear us?
Can you hear us?
Yes, it's soft, but we can hear.
Okay, okay, fine. Okay, let's continue.
And in this particular, there is a kind of so-called myth in Japan, but Hansuga was called myth or misunderstanding that the ISP is always prioritizing balance sheet and ignore profit and loss statement, and emphasizing balance sheet. The ultimate objective of the ISP is to measure everything mark to market. So many kind of textbook on IFRS in Japan partly that kind of statement. So if the conceptual framework can clearly state that is not the case, and both performance and resources are important, then positions are important, then it would help dispel
things. Yes, on this point, I just would like to mention is our financial statement is general purpose financial statement. Therefore, those who might read financial statement may not have any other information and may not have any other measure to access to the information. So therefore, we would like to provide, we would like to require entities to provide any information available. So that is why our objective prioritizes the financial statement type, user type more. However, as you pointed out, we have two objectives, and we would like to stipulate it clearly, explicitly mention that we have two objectives. So I think that is the improvement. However, the question is, there are many cases where we see the conflict between the information to be presented to the users and the information which might be useful for the management, and it might be useful to assess the stewardship. However, still, we think that for the management purposes, management may have other information resources to assess their stewardship between themselves. So therefore, if there is a conflict, and that is very severe conflict, perhaps we cannot neglect the information to be presented to the users. So that is the basic notion shared with board members. Of course, that will be improved. However, many board members share such kind of notion. I think still that is best.
By saying stewardship, I don't mean to say supporting management and board, but rather supporting broad investors assessing the competence and the achievement of management.
Okay, any other opinion?
That's only conceptual thinking in the special number of objectives.
Yes, we would like to go through.
Okay, so we'll move on to the number of measurement bases, which is the next section of the agenda paper. In developing the discussion paper, the ISB discussed whether the conceptual framework should state that all assets and liabilities should be measured on the same basis. And this would have the advantage that it may make financial statements more understandable, at least totals or subtotals of numbers more understandable. But I think in looking at that, there were problems with this approach, and that was that measuring all assets and liabilities, say, on a cost basis, may not always provide relevant information, and a derivative is a good example of a situation where that would not provide relevant information, or in some cases current market prices may not give relevant information. For example, where you're using assets and liabilities to get, or assets to produce a margin, and in those cases the cost basis may be more relevant. So based on this, the board's preliminary view in the conceptual framework would be to not measure assets and liabilities on the same basis, so therefore to say that more than one measurement basis would be appropriate. It did also say that even though it may have that decision, it would want to limit the ultimate number of measurement bases, because the more measurement bases there are, it may be sort of inhibit understandability. So with that introduction, the question for this point is that, do you agree with the IFB's preliminary view that the conceptual framework should not recommend measuring all assets and liabilities on the same basis? And do you agree that the IFB should limit the number of different measurements used to the smallest number necessary to provide relevant information?
Thank you very much. We are supportive of the IFB's preliminary view that conceptual framework should not recommend measuring all the assets and liability on the same basis. We have learned a lot from the past experience, such as the IS37 revision and revenue recognition project, whether to their value the contract assets and liabilities, and also even within the financial instruments, we have the two different measurements. In that sense, measuring all the assets and liabilities by single method is not the goal of standard setting. So we support your remarks. But in the same time, we do not necessarily agree with limiting the number of measurements. That is not the target of the standard setting. If you follow the logical flow of the perspective of financial position or financial performance, the result, the number of measurements will be limited as a result. So if you want to say something, I think you should say such kind of thing.
Thank you, sir. We agree with the recommend that we should not have one single measurement basis. We also receive feedback from some of our constituents that perhaps the business model is important in determining the different measurement basis used by IFRS, for example, whether it should be at cost or at fair value. And business model actually can play a role in assisting the IFB in determining the appropriate measurement basis that is most reflective of the economic reality of an asset or liability vis-a-vis operation of the reporting entity. We agree with the concept of a mixed measurement model, as noted in the discussion paper. A single measurement model would not provide relevant or useful information, and we also agree to limit the number of measures used in order to reduce complexity and for financial information to be more understandable. I understand it's important to provide relevant information, so I think that should be
maybe some balance between relevance and understandability. Yep, thank you. I'm a relatively newcomer, so please allow me to have a basic question.
Mm-hmm.
I understand your comments, and I fully agree with the multiple measurement basis. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm a bit surprised that this is the issue. Because is there any investors or the, from the viewpoint of objective you mentioned, the support on the single measurement basis? From what point? I can understand logically one single measurement basis, simple, understandable. That's understandable. But the, from the viewpoint of objective, is there any support on that?
There is some limited support for that, and I think as Ryota pointed out, there is a perception that historically the ISB has been supportive of a single measurement basis. Whether that's been true or not is debatable, but I think this has really put at a conceptual level the view that that is not the case. So whether it is an issue, I think there has been a perception that there is an issue, and this has been really to articulate at a conceptual high level that that is not the objective of the ISB.
I think this is one of the most important points, whether we have a single measurement or still stay on the measurement stage. The reason why we raised up this issue in this conceptual framework is because this is the kind of structural thing, and we have to make clear that since our standpoint is mixed measurement rather than single measurement, because if we have a mixed measurement, the total sum have a little meaning. And that means residual or balance, whatever the amount we are financial statements provide, may differ from the actual residual balance. So that's why that is the shortcomings of mixed measurement. Knowing that, we think mixed measurement is better than the single measurement. That is one of the most important messages we need to stipulate, we need to make clear in the conceptual framework. That is why we raised this issue here again and clearly stated that we stay on the mixed measurement.
Well, I have basically the same opinion with that mentioned by Ipo earlier, which is agree with the first question and disagree with the second one. To me, it is quite natural to use multiple measures as we are living in such a complex world. And use of multiple measures was distinct as a mixed bag approach by the ISB up until several years ago, when the ISB was aiming to establish a single measurement model, a fair body only model. But each and every measure that have been used has its own rationales and necessities. So I praise the ISB for abandoning a single measurement model and proposing a multiple measurement model. Having said that, still I see a sort of a smell of articulation for a single measurement model in paragraph 6.23 of the discussion paper, where it is said that the number of measures should be limited to the smallest number necessary. The relevant standards are developed, then the number of measures used should be an optimal one. So therefore there is no need that the smallest number necessary should be written as an explicit goal. I'm afraid when the smallest number is written as a target, then the necessary measures might be eliminated, wiped out from the backup.
I think what was meant by that was more creating some discipline around the selection of a measurement basis, and that was, I think, primarily in the context of other cash flow based measures where the board is trying to put some discipline around just tweaking measurement basis to every fact and circumstance, and maybe being a bit more disciplined about looking at the measurement basis that are currently used and whether those would be appropriate. But I take your point that I don't think we meant it as a goal. rather than a discipline, but I take the point that's been discussed here, that perhaps the framework itself and having that framework may create that discipline naturally, rather than having a language to the extent to limit the number.
I understand there's a need for discipline, but simultaneously I know that all the ISB members and the staff are very serious hard workers. So when there is a written goal of the smallest number, there will be competition between the numbers.
Thank you. Any other comments on this issue?
Yes, it's Jim Paul here from Australia. I'm sorry that we don't have video contact, so I'm a bit, it could be interrupting or cutting off somebody if I have, but I'm sorry for that. My personal view is that there should be a single concept of wealth, and in my own mind I have a clear distinction between the role of the conceptual framework and the role of standards, in the sense that it may be that at a standards level there will be different measurement attributes chosen because of practical or cost-benefit considerations, for example, or difficulties in obtaining the information for a particular chosen measure. But we'd prefer that the framework sets an overall direction that can guide the development in a coherent manner of the selection of measurement choices in individual standards. And Christy, I hear your point that the ISB is being criticised unfairly for having an agenda to just bring in fair value across the board, and certainly agree that that was not the case. But so I can understand you're trying to get that message out there, but we think there needs to be some concept of wealth that not only determines a consistent way, as you've referred to in paragraph 6.12 of the discussion paper about the understandability of the amounts that are reported, but also that it will guide, in my view, the determination of economic income for the period. In other words, this will have a big impact on the whole question of profit and loss, other comprehensive income and recycling. We'll come, obviously, to the recycling question later on, but I'm just putting a marker down that I see that as all very much connected. So that's where we're coming from in Australia generally.
Jim, just on that concept of wealth, is that a measurement, or what is that notion?
It is I guess you could call it a measurement objective. It's an economic principle. I'll give you some examples. It could be invested money capital, which is what we see with a strict historical cost model, but with impairment included, because you've lost some of your capital with there's an impairment. So that's consistent with the general model that we have today. If we put aside such items as derivatives or investment property, or it could be current cash equivalents, which are the adaptive capacity of the entity at any given point in time to sell all of its assets or transfer all its liabilities at that time. Or it could be an operating capability notion, which is more to do with the longer term perspective of the resources being managed to ultimately generate cash flows that can be distributed to owners or also provided to creditors and other interested parties. So in making that comment, I raise your point that you referred to paragraph 6.13d about the problems with having a single approach, and the it doesn't seem to work if you have, for example, all current value. Implicit in that to me was the exit value notion that's in fair value, because naturally enough there's a lot of emphasis on fair value given that's the main alternative to cost in IFRS's. But conceptually I would be keen for the ISB to think about not only exit prices but current entry prices, which is where operating capability would come into play. And operating capability is, I guess in shorthand, would be replacement cost for non-financial assets, and fair value for financial assets and liabilities, because there won't be a difference between operating capability and current cash equivalents of those items. Implicit in all that is I don't support historical costs because I think that it's outdated information for decision making.
Thanks, Jim. So we'll move on to then the selection of a measurement, and the IFB believes that the relevance of a particular measurement will depend on how users are likely to assess how an asset or liability will contribute to an entity's future cash flows. So the IFB's preliminary view was that the selection of a measurement for a particular asset should depend on how it contributes to future cash flows, and for a particular liability should depend on how the entity will settle or fulfil that liability. And the tables in paragraph 11 of agenda paper 1 set out how we think that applies to assets and particular types of liabilities. In some cases, the board may decide that more than one measure is relevant for a particular asset or liability. And in that case, the board would have a decision whether to use one measure in the primary financial statements and disclose the other measure, or perhaps have one measure in one primary financial statement, the statement of financial position, and another measure reflected in another primary financial statement, in particular the profit and loss account. And we discussed that in that option in Section 8 of the discussion paper when we talk about profit and loss and OCI. So in terms of selection of a measurement, the question that I want to put to you is, do you agree with the IFB's preliminary view that the selection of a measurement should be for a particular asset should depend on how it is contributes to future cash flows, and for a particular liability should depend on how the entity will settle or fulfil that liability? And also, do you agree that in some cases more than one measurement basis would be relevant, and if so, how the IFB should deal with that?
Generally, we support the IFB's preliminary views because it says the selection of the measurement is based on how it contributes to cash flow, which is similar to our idea, which is we believe the selection of measurement is based on the entity's investment. Anyway, the most important thing is that written in paragraph 12 and 13, Himino-san already touched, there should be different measurement bases. One is relevant for the statement of financial position, the other is the measurement relevant for the statement of profit or loss and OCI. Such kind of, when you say selection, so you have two aspects. Now ASCJ is preparing the agenda paper for December 8th meeting. So we are going to submit it today or within a couple of days. For example, the table in the paragraph 11, we modify this kind of table a little bit expanded. For example, likely measurement, we divided this column into two. Likely measurement for financial position purposes and financial performance purposes. So such kind of analysis may be needed for further discussion.
Thank you. Feeling, please.
Thank you, sir. in January agree with the ISB preliminary view, but there's one point that I would like to ask for clarification, specifically in relation to question 12, item D about an entity's target to use of an asset. The relevance of a particular measure of those assets will depend on the significance of the individual asset to the entity. My question to you, Christine, is how would this significant concept be different from the materiality concept? And we understand that materiality concept is embedded with the concept of relevance, and it's not really a concept in selecting a measurement basis. So we struggle to understand that, you know, here you're using significance, and then also whether the concept, materiality concept, is selecting a measurement basis is appropriate. And especially I think for those jurisdictions which need to translate into their national language, I mean, sometimes we need to be mindful of material significance, then what's the appropriate word to be translated into the national language?
In response, I'm not sure that we were considering that it being a materiality discussion. We were thinking more about the size and the nature of the asset compared to the operations, rather than whether the asset itself was material. But I do take your point about the use of language around size and quantity. In IS1, for example, we will use important, significant, material. As an aside, it's not part of the conceptual framework project, but some of the work we're going to do on disclosures and in around IS1, I think we'll look at that question, because we need to be clear and more precise around when we use a descriptive term like that, whether we mean materiality, and if we mean something else, be clear about how that relates to materiality. So I do take the point, but I don't think we meant a materiality discussion here. I was more thinking about the asset in terms of its nature. Would be, it may be material in both circumstances, whether you apply the cost model or the fair value model, but I think the size and nature was meant to be so much more, I'm going to use the word term significant, but quite impactful to the business. But yes, I do take the point.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I agree with the first question, but although it was elaborated earlier, the table could be expanded further clarity. And in order to answer the question B of the second question, let me explain what kind of information we users want to get from the financial statement. We need to have two kinds of information. The first one is flow-based information, how much a company earns in a given year. And the cost-based accounting is more suitable, measurement is more suitable for this purpose. The second information that we want to obtain from the financial statement is stock-based information. What the company's financial position, its financial safety and health. In order to get this information, certain assets and liabilities are better to be measured at fair value. So therefore, using the two measures, one for P&L, one for balances, actually accommodate for the user the information needs. So in this regard, again, I commend the ANP explicitly mentioning that you're going to use the two measures. As to the first question A of the second question, let me give you one good example, which is the financial liabilities of non-financial companies. When book value and fair value are widely different, the fair value information may offer
interesting information. However, most of these liabilities are held to maturity. And after maturity, obviously, all the variation gains or losses are evaporated to be zero. And therefore, putting it on the balance sheet may confuse the users, and therefore put it on the balance sheet would be a safest and most appropriate way.
Put it in the
on the notes, yes.
About the measurement of the liability, I may not be updated because I'm not an expert in this field, but one of the major criticisms I heard when I visited the European countries, especially the UK and France, was the measurement basis or measurement way of measurement on the liability. Because when the credit risk of the company goes up and the liability goes down, and the then profit comes, and the directors took all the profit from that. That is a problem in the Europe. And I may not be updated, but by defining or by proposing the likely measurement like this, would this change the criticism or the it is not the case? That's my question.
I think the conceptual framework doesn't specify that if you choose a particular measurement basis, how that measurement basis is calculated. I think it gives some factors that should be considered when making or determining that measure, but it doesn't go into prescriptive detail about what is entailed in each measure. So if you did have a current market price measure of fair value, it doesn't stipulate that own credit should be considered or part of that measure for the liability. It says effectively at a standards level the board should determine that, but it may want to consider credit of the issuer in determining what would be an appropriate measure. So I don't think it addresses that concern, other than it saying that it would be a consideration, which I think people would want it to be a consideration in that discussion, but it doesn't dictate which way the board would determine the measure at the standards level. So it gives a framework for making that determination rather than specifying what it should be.
Yeah, I think that shows that I'm not an expert in this field, because the people in the business field are interested in how it changed, how the certain economic transaction should be measured, rather than the difference between the conceptual framework or the standard. My question should have been that by defining the conceptual framework like this, would it affect to the standard so that the criticism which I mentioned would be softened or would be disappeared?
I don't think it would change that discussion because it wouldn't say whether you should or you shouldn't include it. I'm sorry, I'm not understanding.
My question would be difficult to understand. Okay, I change the question in this way. Is this proposal different from the current conceptual framework, which affects to the individual standard now under Greece?
The current conceptual framework has very little on measurement. So the standard that specifies own credit really has been done in isolation or without a framework. So this is trying to put the some framework around that discussion. So when we have prepared this discussion paper, our purpose was to update some sections and fill the gaps with others. And measurement and what we're going to discuss later, profit and loss in OCI, are places where we're filling gaps, where the board has effectively been developing standards with little conceptual guidance behind it.
I agree with Christine on this point. I don't think we cannot directly solve this issue. However, the question you raised is one of the most important questions for the conceptual framework. This is not just for the measurement, but also this includes some basic concepts about internal generated goodwill. Because the reason why we decrease the own credit relates to the internal generated goodwill. So the purpose of the financial statement is to provide proper figures of the entity, but it is not directly measure the value of the residual of the entity. So that's why we do not directly measure internally generated goodwill. And however, in the case of liability, if the own credit value decreases, that would reflect it to the liability. But on the other hand, on the asset side, as we do not value the internally generated goodwill or such kind of internal value of the asset side, therefore there is some difference. That is one of the basic problems of mixed measurement and mixed recognition criteria. So it must be treated differently, not only just measurement issues. And this is one of the most important and difficult challenge for us to address in the conceptual basis. But this is a very good point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I like the idea of the clean surplus, of course, you mentioned. We should explain the residual coming from the balance sheet. But at the same time, I strongly recommend the IFRS to, of course, you address that, but to reconsider this. Because as far as I understood from the discussion in Europe and with the US, not US, but particularly in Europe, is this point. The measuring the liability from the credit and the reducing, increasing the credit risk makes the company the increase of profit. That is the contradictory, or the that is a conflict with the instinctive understanding.
And the standards are trying to deal with some of that concern, and so there is an exposure draft to deal with that. So we have taken it on board at a standards level.
Quickly, but in regard to that question, looking at the liabilities table on the page 7, then it says that the liabilities measure that the current market practice to be transferred liabilities. Mm-hmm. So if a company has financial liabilities and it has a hidden gain in terms of the lower credit, higher credit rate, and then when it is sort of currently under negotiation of actually selling that liability and realize the gain, then it could be measured by the current market value. But unless until that kind of negotiation not happening, then it should be kept up at the cost, because it is a liability according to
city terms.
Couldn't be the interpretation of this table on the page.
And these are like likely measurement, yes. As in, it would seem likely that if you are trading your liability, I'd say if you have a practice of selling your debt securities and buying them back and realizing the gains and losses to your own credit or interest, then maybe it is more likely that you would have a current market price basis. If your view is to generally hold them to maturity and the board determines that's the general overview when setting a standard, then it may go for a cost measure. But this is the most likely measurement. It's not trying to stipulate that's the way the board may go. So it would just take the facts and circumstances when setting a standard.
Yes, I'm good.
Thank you. Earlier today, we then emphasized the importance of business models, and I think the current proposal is kind of linking business model and slightly measurement basis. How the assets contribute to future cash flows, represent business model of the entity. So I think this is going in a real direction. I have two comments. One is, for example, assets for using is to be measured by cost. Yes, property, plant, equipment will be measured as cost. But we do depreciation of plant and equipment. And do we do that for maybe for balance purposes? The depreciation is reflecting the real decline in the value? No, I think depreciation is done mainly to have a profit and loss statement, right? So, although you said the paragraph 13 is a key part of the document, and I think this aspect, when choosing the measurement approach, we need to think both about balance sheet and profit and loss statement. That idea can be incorporated into the selection of a measurement part. For example, not just saying cost for plant and equipment, but depreciation to make it more useful for profit and loss statement purposes. My second question is related to how the assets contribute to future cash flows. For example, there are certain instruments for selling, certain instruments holding for collection, but there can also be an instrument the entity holds for collection, but not exclude the possibility of selling. So there can be other types of business models in addition to the four listed in the asset section. So maybe to be more closer to those kind of business models, maybe the categorization might need to be funded.
I think that follows on the point the ASBJA made regarding perhaps extending this table to a profit and loss and a balance sheet.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to make some comments. I agree with you with your basic idea, but I think there is still room for improvement in some areas. For example, it seems that there are some different items some different items are mixed in the category of selling. There are some items which is for which current market value is relevant, but I think there is some others which are not for which current market value is not relevant. For example, items that can be sold immediately in any time in a liquid market. In other words, items selling in an perfect or close to perfect market, as you said, current market value or current market price may be relevant. Mm-hmm. But for items that is not that is sold in an imperfect market, current market price may not be relevant. So I think separation will be necessary for the two items. That's all.
Thank you, sir. I agree that you should fill the gap because the current conceptual framework, there's not much discussion about the measurement basis. But I think at the same time, I hope that the conceptual framework should provide a neutral principle on the measurement basis, because I think I'm quite worried reading question 13, where you kind of like you give a different principle between liabilities with or without stated items. So that's the actually, if you like, the conceptual of differentiating that they are liabilities with stated items on one measurement basis without stated items on another measurement basis. That if you start going on that route, are we tying our hands tight? What happens, let's say, in your future standard, you may need to have certain measurement basis, for example, for some very good reason, and yet then in your conceptual framework you have tied yourself so prescriptive in a sense. I mean, I take note that your conceptual framework doesn't override the standard, but whether is it a right choice to be so tight. What I'm trying to say is I think it's better to have a neutral basis because this is only a conceptual framework.
Shall we move on?
Thank you. Yeah, I was wondering if the framework could focus more on concepts rather than details, because I think the discourse paper includes many details and examples. I think maybe the framework could explain the measurement methods more generally rather than trying to categorize items into some three or four. I think the details should be included in the standard, and also each standard can explain why a particular measurement basis is used in that standard, because I have problem with, for example, inventories of categorization, so I prefer focusing more on concepts.
And just more generally on that, this discussion paper is a lot more detailed than we would expect to see in the conceptual framework, and that was, in effect, to provide people with a good basis for discussion. So I would expect the next, what we issue in the exposure draft, to be a lot more succinct, but a lot more reflective of what would actually go into the conceptual framework.
Okay. If I could come in here, but let me know if someone else was about to speak. It's Jim Paul here. I just wanted to say briefly that I'm not keen on basing the measurement of individual items on the way in which they'll generate cash flows. That's first of all because I'm thinking about a concept of wealth being the driver, in which case you don't need to think about the individual cash flows. Secondly, if thinking about cash flows as an investor or creditor, I tend to think of it from the point of view of the business as a whole, and there can be a business unit that has some assets generating cash flows directly and some that are support assets that you don't charge people, but they're necessary to enable the other assets to generate cash flows. So given the point that is in the discussion paper that all assets generate cash flows one way or another, then to break that down seems artificial to me because it seems inconsistent with the way businesses are run. And it seems narrower also than paragraph OB19 of the conceptual framework, objective chapter that notes that cash flows that are ultimately able to be paid come from cash flows, but also changes in value are also indicative of cash flows that ultimately can be generated. And I note that paragraph 6.19 of the discussion paper identifies significant exceptions to the overall rule in relation to financial assets and financial liabilities, which calls into question, in my mind, the rigour of the proposed principle that's there. And finally, I wanted to ask a question, a rhetorical question, because I know that we're pressed for time. That's just something maybe to take on board for later, is that paragraph 6.16 focuses on how users will assess how the asset will contribute to cash flows. And I know that that's, it seems that that's trying to avoid management intent being too, having too much influence, but it's one step removed for the users to reach different conclusions than management about how cash flows will be generated. Seems a little confusing to me, but that's just an area which I think could be a bit murky. Thank you for allowing me that opportunity to make that comment.
Thanks, Jim. Given that we're running somewhat behind schedule, I will combine the last two questions of the agenda paper one, and we've talked a little bit anyway already, I think, about the ISB's preliminary view that it should consider both the impact on the profit and loss statement and the statement of financial position. It should also consider whether the benefits of a particular measure are enough to justify the costs of requiring that measure. So I'd ask you if you had any comments, further comments on that point, and whether you have any other further comments on the items that we list in that paragraph, which we've listed in paragraph 14.
Do you have any comments?
I have rather a question rather than a comment. In the discussion paper, you hope that the existing method and the foreign currency transaction from the discussion. And I wonder if, because there are many issues in practice, I wonder why you scoped out the discussion entirely from the discussion paper about the existing method and the foreign currency transaction.
Yes, it was that, one, I think there's a question as to what those might actually be. Are they measurements? Are they something else? And I think good discussion of that, I think, involves quite a good discussion about the actual underlying standards and the principles behind them. And then we felt that that was quite a bigger issue than what we could address in this discussion paper, because I think it goes to a lot about whether you support the underlying notions in IAS 21 and the equity method accounting. So primarily it was because we felt it was a bit like capital maintenance, something that was better dealt with sort of outside this discussion paper.
So you think it's necessary to have some concept for example, for equity methods, but it's too big to deal with in the...
I think it would be dealt with at a standards level. I think what we learn in that may feed into the conceptual framework, but in terms of this project, I think we felt it was too large a discussion to be had here. But we do take on board that in terms of measurement, what is FX translation? Is it a measurement? Is it a capital maintenance adjustment? And we haven't touched a lot on capital maintenance adjustments other than a recognition that those items are not considered to be income and expense. But we haven't dealt a significant amount of time in this discussion paper because it is a considerable project in itself.
Thank you. Is there any other comments for the agenda one? We can discuss later, of course. Then, if you don't have, let us move on to the second issue, which is profit or loss and other comprehensive income.
So this is agenda paper 2, and in this paper, in this section, we'd like to get your reactions to section 8. Of the discussion paper, which is about presentation in the statement of comprehensive income, and in particular profit and loss and other comprehensive income. And the first section I want to ask you about is financial performance. Some stakeholders have asked the IFB to define what is meant by the term financial performance. We think that financial performance can mean many things to many people, and an assessment of financial performance and information that contributes to that assessment can come from many places in the financial statements. We do think that the statement of comprehensive income, however, gives you information that is useful in assessing financial performance. And that's primary information about the return the entities have made on their resources. And therefore, the discussion paper seeks to address how best to present that information in terms of the subtotal, particularly about financial performance. So in terms of that question, I want to ask question one, which is, in the discussion paper, the IFB does not define financial performance. Do you agree that it should not?
Thank you.
agree that the term financial performance is difficult to define, but it's different. It is difficult for profit or loss to be defined as a component of financial statements. Assets and liabilities defined first, then the equity is defined as it is residual, then the gross income and gross expenses are defined in the current framework as the increase and decrease of assets and liabilities. But here, what we can do is profit or loss and comprehensive income should be defined in the net base, like net changes in net assets during the period. The one is based on the measurement of the assets and liability based on the from the balance sheet perspective. Mm-hmm. The other one is from the perspective of financial performance. And that's it. Then the assets and liability, when the assets and liability disappears, the difference of the measurement disappears, which is the mechanism of OCI recycling.
Any other comments?
I think profit and loss statement, sorry, the financial performance is a key concept. So it sounds to me a bit odd that we cannot define it anywhere in the document. And I suppose it shouldn't be defined in presentation sector, but rather given a proper place in purpose and element section. And I suppose I understand there are two key purposes: helping investors and making future investment decisions, and helping investors assess and towards both management. And to attain two purposes, both financial position and financial performance can contribute in different ways. Financial performance statement takes a point-in-time picture of the corporation to help investors assess future, think about future investment. And the financial performance presents a periodic picture of the corporation. And it can help future investment decision, because if the financial performance is presented in a way to help assess future performance, it can help investors make investment decisions. And if the financial performance is presented to clearly indicate how the management discharges their responsibility, it can help investors assess stewardship. So that kind of purpose, role of financial performance and position, if that is clearly stated and located in purpose and element section, then the job for presentation and measurement section would be much easier. And I think there is a good idea presented in page 7, paragraph 17. Profit and loss provides a primary source of information about the return an entity has made on its economic sources in a studio. And if we kind of clearly state the goal for financial performance statement, then we should try to make profit and loss the best suited indicator for helping investors make future decisions and make assessment of the stewardship. So maybe we cannot make a precise exact
in the definition of profit and loss, but still we can aim to define or construct profit and loss notion according to the purpose and the objective. And this section says, anything can help investors make decisions, comprehensive income, OCI, profit and loss, or other measures used by analysts, like, I cannot sum up it, but if we think everything can contribute, it's true, but that is different from we define the purpose of profit and loss and make that indicator best suited for the purpose. So I think this section tends to equate profit and loss and other indicators in too much on the equal standing. I think profit and loss should have a particular status in the whole financial statement, and that is the current practice of readers of financial statements.
Just may I understand, you are not really suggesting we should equate a profit loss as a performance, or do you suggest it?
I think the profit and loss, financial performance can be assessed in various ways. Mm-hmm. It has various ways. But if we start to say anything can help assess financial performance, it's a kind of anarchy type of I think the financial performance cannot be equated with profit and loss. If we equate it, profit and loss statement should tell everything about financial performance. That's impossible. But trying to make the profit and loss the best indicator of financial performance, that should be possible. So by saying it's not omnipotent, we shouldn't abandon the effort to make it better.
But in a proposal, we are saying that profit loss is the major communication tool for the performance. So in this sense, we are not clearly equate the profit loss is the performance. However, we would like to indicate that profit or loss is still important, and this is the most important communication tool for the investor to know what the performance is. So we are very near to what you would like to describe.
Yes, I think it's a big step, and I very much welcome that, and I encourage further steps to put it not in presentation only, but in purpose and evidence.
And might as well open up the discussion, because I think we're leaning into it about, you know, as Chuck said, that we have said that profit and loss is important, and that it is the primary measure of the information that the income statement provides about performance, and that is question two. So I think that sort of coming into the discussion here, so we might as well discuss that point as well.
I agree with the previous two speakers that we need a clear definition of performance or say net income and OCI. And lack of the definition is a source of confusion in today. And the previous discussion paper simply couldn't define the income, because at that time the ultimate goal or dream of many board members was to abolish net income and make it comprehensive income higher. So now you people admit that net income is necessary. This is about the time you will clearly define these things. And in the discussion paper, it is said that many investors disregard the comprehensive income. Why? Because we don't regard it as income. Then what it is? It is only variation gains and losses at the balance sheet date. So the nomenclature of the OCI is inappropriate, in my view. And it should be renamed as the
other tentative variation gains and losses, something like this. And anyway, these things should be clearly defined in the element section of the conceptual framework to make the conceptual framework really robust.
Thank you.
Actually, we agree with the three gentlemen. We think the profit and loss is a very important notion in financial reporting. So we agree with them that the profit and loss should be defined in, as an element of the financial statement. In addition, in China, profit and loss is a very important notion for the business operation. For example, the company law requires such an item. For another example, the many regulations or some other business evaluations are based on the profit and loss information. We think profit and loss should be defined, and it's a very important notion. And I think that's also our answer to question two. We agree that conceptual framework should require profit or loss as a total or subtotal on the statement of profit and loss of OCI. Thank you.
Other comments?
Yes, you
at
question number one, right?
Question one and two. They seem to meld together, so if anybody has any other point on question two that they want to ask, add, please do.
Regarding question one, I agree with the previous speakers on the views on the financial performance. Because objective of financial reporting states that financial performance helps users to understand the return entity produced and the use for assessing further future cash flows. It's important to define that financial performance, but I agree that the financial performance, concept of financial performance is very broad and includes many things. So maybe it's difficult to define the financial performance, but rather it may be helpful to describe the concept of financial performance and include the notion that profit loss is very important concept in the financial performance.
Should we move on to recycling and thinking determining that we should retain a subtotal for profit and loss and a separate section for OCI? The question of recycling is an important one. And the board determined, for the reasons set out in Table 2 in paragraph 11, that it did wish to retain the notion of recycling for some or all of items that are in OCI. So the question that I want to ask is question three, which is the ISB's preliminary view is that the conceptual framework should permit or require at least some items of income and expense previously recognised in OCI to be recognised subsequently in profit and loss, so to be recycled. Do you agree with that? And if not, why not?
Firstly, we support the theory, support the idea of profit or loss to be presented on the statement of profit or loss and OCI. But we believe that net profit or loss is not a subtotal of comprehensive income. Difference comes from the measurement of the asset and liability. So after the defining the profit or loss and the comprehensive income, we have to analyze the difference in other words, why we have to have two different measurements for the same asset of liability, or the character of net asset. So the character of profit or loss, I mean the character of the profit or loss, could be explained in many ways. But the one character is it should represent all the assets and liabilities, all inclusive measurements, should be all inclusive measurements. And nothing is out of the scope. So that means eventually, in an entire period, total profit or loss and comprehensive income to become the same number, and also the net cash flow. And what is the difference between the net, profit or loss and the comprehensive income? The nature of comprehensive income is currently difficult because IASB doesn't take the single measurement based at this point. So, for example, depreciation is used for profit or loss, and also comprehensive income is in common. It's difficult, but profit or loss could be explained in the as representing a responsible outcome of entity's business activities in certain periods. That is a kind of explanation.
Irreversible.
And back to the measurement of asset and liability. There are two different measurements. So the, if we have the two different measurements for single asset and liability, the difference is becomes OCI as a linkage factor. You analyze OCI as three different categories, but we don't think we need such detailed analysis. A breathing item or something and something should be combined in the one category, difference coming from the measurement difference. So OCI is a linkage factor, and when the asset and liability are de-recognized, this appears. So the OCI is a product of the timing difference, of the recognition timing of profit or loss and the comprehensive income. So as through such a mechanism, inevitably profit or loss becomes all inclusive, and OCI is always decided.
So would something that's difficult to determine a basis for recycling, would that then drive maybe how you categorize or where you put that measure, whether it's in profit or loss or in OCI? So for example, we found it difficult to determine a basis for pensions. Because of that, would that then lead you to a view of how to present the remeasurement of pension liabilities? So the recycling effectively is a driver for how it's presented.
I know the current standard of IAS 19, living instrument treatment, is difficult to it's difficult for recycling, because it's all or none treatment. So the problem of the new IAS 19 is that we believe the pension cost is that operating cost is very important for the, especially for the manufacturing company. It's a kind of personnel expenses, purely the operating expenses. And the remeasurement difference is a part of such labor cost, which should be included in the operating income. When if you put that in the OCI as the IS 19, then you got the chance of sustainable expense become operating expense. That's a very difficult point of an agreeable point of the IS 19, but it's difficult to solve the issue under the current IS 19. Okay. So something has to be changed.
But I suppose as a basis, the notion of recycling would drive. It embodies why you put something into OCI in the first place, because you would expect it always to recycle, so it will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think paragraph 70B and page 7 makes it very clear what should be put in OCI and what shouldn't be. OCI should be used it makes profit and loss more relevant, enhances the relative value of profit or loss, or makes it more understandable. I think this should be the key criteria. And if you have difficulty in finding the timing, etc., of recycling, shouldn't drive the decision. It should be subsidiary to the key consideration 17B rather than kind of K1.
I'm actually a firm believer that everything, every OCI item should be recycled. Two reasons. The first is the difference of the hardness of the information. Variation gains or losses changes every day and night. When you sell it, settle it, then that's it. Fixed, no change. So this hard information should be reflected in that income. The second reason is that the only theoretical reason for non-recycling is that the income should be recognized only once. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned earlier, many users do not regard OCI as an income in the first place. So this argument does not hold for me. And also as to the pension recycling we have been discussing, actually our society, the Secretary American Association, wrote a comment letter to your exposure draft and recommended to make the trigger point of the cash inflows and outflows in between the pension fund and sponsor entities. In other words, when the pension is deep in a deficit, the sponsor company have to pay cash, invest cash into the pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
Then at this time, the same amount should be recognized as losses. This is a trigger point. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when the pension is running a surplus, theoretically speaking, pension can pay back money to the sponsor entity. If actually happens, then at that time it will be recorded as the profit for the entity. So trigger events like you also mentioned, you can find it if you work hard. So no trigger event wouldn't be no excuse for no recycling.
Just quick question to say. So in that case, what is the unit of account? Unit of account is the fund? Fund, total fund.
Sorry, I don't understand what you're asking.
So you mean, so if the fund itself continues without any trigger event,
mm-hmm.
so then it, the recycle opportunity wouldn't come. So may I understand
it? Yes. This is a good question. Actually, there would be a third causes because imagine most of the pension surplus allocated according to the asset modeling. So they will go up and down. So if they say it will be quite to zero, in that case, there will be only the continuous fluctuation within the accumulated OCI, and finally it will be settled in zero when the company is liquidated in the long term. There will be a third cost.
Since this is a round table, I come from the government side, as well as the listening to the business side, and the, from that viewpoint, the two comments or the two findings I found during the discussion with the business people and the investors as well. The one is recycling. Nobody understands the word recycling. Recycling is used for other purpose. Only this community use the recycling for this purpose. That's the first thing. The second one is nobody, almost nobody, to whom I met said comprehensive income or other comprehensive income is useful as an indicator for the financial performance or indicator for the assessment. They said balance is important, but the comprehensive income or the other comprehensive income itself depends are not very useful for assessing the performance, which is of course described in the first part of this discussion paper. So combining these two not useful information coming from that not understandable word recycling, nobody could understand that. And I join the comment maybe Kaneko-san mentioned. The investors want to have useful information to assess the financial performance as discussed in the first part of this discussion. And which major profit and loss statement, and during the certain period of time, what kind of information should be disclosed, what kind of information should be measured. That is the key indicator or the key information the investor wants, rather than having the other comprehensive income or comprehensive income, whether or not it should be recycled in certain period. That is not point, actually. So what kind of information is needed for a certain period of time? So from that viewpoint, maybe defining clearly what the profit and loss should be like for measuring the performance or the financial performance from that viewpoint in a certain period of time is necessary, rather than having a word recycling.
I think it builds on the ASBJ's point that we have it a little bit in the discussion paper, that it's an automatic response to what you put in profit and loss rather than a proactive removal out of other comprehensive income. So it focuses on what you put in profit and loss, and what goes in there is a response, and how it's taken out of OCI is a response to what and why you put something into profit and loss in the first point.
Just one point. I raise this point because this is a discussion on the conceptual framework rather than the individual standard. When it comes to the individual standard, it may be difficult which what kind of financial performance or what kind of profit loss statement all the companies should have, because it's an international standard. But it is an international or conceptual or a conceptual framework. So I raise this point as a conceptual level discussion.
I would just raise one point about it not being, the information in other comprehensive income not being useful. I think we would question that, because I think for some companies and for some measures there is useful information in there, and that's why when we talk about profit and loss being the primary measure, it doesn't mean that the information in other comprehensive income is not useful. We do actually think in some cases that can be very useful and important information, and we want to ensure that companies do look, or users do look at it. but it may not be the first thing they look at.
Along Tapia's line, I would like to say the word recycling is a very biased word. The paper has a primary purpose, then disposed, then recycled to other use. So the first use in appearance in the balance sheet and the comprehensive income statement is the primary use.
Mm.
And then the element is recycled to a highly nutritious secondary use. That is recycling. Now that ICB has stated profit and loss provides the primary source of information, the primary thing is profit and loss statement. But of course, OCI and comprehensive income is also important and useful. But now it's a bit awkward to use the word recycling. Thank you.
Thank
you. What I observe, currently we have already in our existing items literature about, you know, OCI, you know, and to a certain extent, very prescriptive, like only certain standards say you can recycle.
Mm-hmm.
We don't understand why certain standards say so, why certain standards, upcoming standards that don't allow you to recycle. So in that sense, it will be, I think it will be very good for the conceptual framework to define like what items can be in the OCI and what items, a principle to be given in the conceptual framework, what items can be in the OCI or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that about all the comments about recycling, but should the ISP decide to move ahead with this recycling, I think we would welcome the broad approach. I think we have three approaches that you welcome the broad approach.
I think on that point it might be worth, just unconscious of the time, moving to, and I'll combine the two questions 4 and 5 and the approaches that we took in the discussion paper regarding profit and loss and OCI, and that we sought to describe OCI rather than profit and loss, and we, by using describing different categories of times that we would use OCI, and they're listed in tables 3 and 4, we suggested two approaches that could be used to determine or describe OCI. One is a narrow approach, and that embodies the notion of always recycling given what we've put in there, and then there's a broader approach which brings in something that requires a bit more judgment at the board level and may not necessarily require recycling. And I won't go into detail because that would take me a long time. So I will open up the questions 4 and 5, which is, do you support the approach to describe OCI rather than profit and loss? And of the approaches that we've described in the paper, do you support any of those? If you don't support any of those, which one would you prefer?
Firstly, we agree with Elaine that maybe the conceptual framework should give some principle or guidance or criteria on what should be included in OCI rather than just relate to 2 or 3 detailed categories as jewels.
Mm-hmm.
Our first comment. And as for the recycling, we think that all OCI should be recycled when it becomes realized or when the related transaction is completed. If the case, if the ISB agree with such a notion, such a concept that all OCI should be recycled, maybe we can remove the word recycling.
Yes.
So, to avoid such a confusion among persons. That's the second point. And as for the different approaches you proposed in the DP, such as approach 1, approach 2, the 2A approach to B. To tell the truth, maybe we are not seeing support of such an approach to define ODI. All the items you propose, the terms you used in the DP, such as the breeding items, the mismatch remeasurement, the transition transitory remeasurement, this term is very difficult to understand, especially for our non-English speaking countries. It's very difficult for us to translate it in our language.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, they don't understand what is it.
Mm.
So can we remove notions in this approach? That's the first reaction. Another comment on this approach is that we think the OCI issue should be defined at the conceptual level, because we think it seems that the approaches you propose in the DP just try to justify past decisions in the IFRS rather than show the way forward. But we think that is what the conceptual framework should do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our comment.
I think we have heard that there's a sense that we have tried to justify the way that OCI is currently used. And I think there may be sort of an element of truth when we talk about transitory remeasurement. But if you took the narrow approach, just looking at one of the approaches discussed in the discussion paper, I think you would find that I think half or less than half of the items currently in OCI would actually be presented in OCI. So I would actually sort of challenge that idea, because I think we did try and suggest one way that would be contrary to what we currently use.
Yes, this is a reconfirmation of my prior remark. ASBJ's approach is to define the net profit or loss. So the your approach, starting with deciding from OCI, we are not supportive of it. So we should start from profit or loss, and then the OCI is defined as a linkage between comprehensive income and profit or loss. And regarding the approach you showed from 1 to 2B, conceptually we are supportive of approach 2A,
mm-hmm.
but we don't think it's a narrow approach. So your example and item are not necessarily the same as ours. So in our analysis, IAS 19 and IFRS 9 also could be a recycling item.
So it's a different articulation. From what I gather, it's effectively a different articulation of that bridging notion that you have the two measurements in the different statements, but it's how we articulate that that's where we differ.
On this point, I just want to confirm. In the 2A approach, we are saying that the default is profit or loss, and then we try to define the cases which we can use OCI. So do you say that that approach is wrong? I mean, default is profit or loss, and the OCI is a kind of exception.
As long as there are two measurements between the statement of financial position and the financial performance,
then the OCI should be this type. So difficulty is IS-19, so some kind of revision may be needed to contain the OCI and the recycling. Current IS-19, the decision is just to go to OCI.
I have a question. I'm as a representative of Japanese accountant, I'm not blaming you on the use of a lot of accounting jargon. But still, I have a question with regard to how to distinguish between profit and loss and OCI, using like a mismatch and creating items. Both of which jargon is very difficult to understand. You say like in a mismatch, use the word the return over an entity has made, but you said you do not define the word financial performance, and but mismatch is decided based on the using the paragraph 17 word P&L provide the primary source of information about the return of that name.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you think return of that name can be determined? And I really don't know what, without defining financial performance, how do you understand the return? This information will provide the relevant information about the return of an entity.
I think it's the return on its resources, so how does it use its assets and its liabilities in effectively the change, and that's what the income and expense represents, is that change. And I think that we think that it provides information about financial performance, but it's a subset of the information about performance. So it's trying to articulate how do you put that together, or how do you present that in a way that makes that information about performance the easiest to and most accessible to understand. So that was our thinking. I hope that clarifies your question.
So which means you use what we've done differently from the financial performance?
I think it is an aspect of financial performance, and I think we effectively say it's a primary aspect of financial performance. But it's somebody. You could see that a change in, say, a leverage ratio is financial performance, but that has nothing to do with how efficiently or the return you've generated using your assets. So it's one aspect of financial performance, and we think it's an important aspect, but it's not the only aspect of financial performance.
From the practical standpoint, we usually confuse if this is a return of capital or actual, return of the assets. So when you say like the information related to future cash flow, we don't know if it's asset return or capital return.
I'd say what you can generate from your assets and liabilities, not a payment out of them, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Thank you. We support recycling of all items recognized in OCI. We believe net income is a key measure which many investors rely on to assess the company's performance. So in order for net income to be a useful and relevant measure, we think that all items originally excluded from net income should be included in net income. And also, maybe a principle would be based on what should be excluded from net income originally. And maybe the timing of the recycle should be decided at each standard level.
Actually, I was thinking about your observations or comment earlier regarding in response to Kenny's comment that if you look at the if the board were to look at these narrow scopes to A, then the number of items may not be recycled. So maybe my point is more of a general point. I'm just thinking, let's say if the conceptual framework is finalized, and assuming a big assumption that if we go on the narrow approach, so would then the existing standards all will be reviewed to be consistent with the new framework? Because then that will be another big push of amendments and you know how people react to you know a stable platform and things like that. So in short, how would the new framework will impact the existing standards?
That's a very good point. And of course, after we finalize this conceptual framework, we need to check up whether current standard consistent with the new conceptual framework. However, conceptual framework would not override each standard. So each standard should be decided with the proper due process. Then we need to review each standard. However, at the same time, we are saying there might be the case that standard and conceptual framework may have a conflict. And in that case, we ask, we are supposed to describe the reason why there is a conflict. So therefore, revision of the conceptual framework does not mean that revision of all the standards. It does not automatically change the old standards. So in each standard, we need to discuss again what is the right treatment for each individual transaction. However, I accept that Vivian's comment. If we go down to the narrow approach of this OCI concept, perhaps we have to revisit each standard and debate what is the proper treatment.
As you were saying, the recycling is very important because for investors, the income is most important indicator of the performance. And I'm wondering why the such a misunderstanding happens, because the OCI might be more important to the income. Because I guess what investors are doing is maybe we analyze the EBIT. Or it is that in the past season, and because sometimes there is a one-time gain or less included in the net income. So first we analyze the it is that in the past season. But what we are doing do is to analyze or the future net income in the future. So you know the so in that sense, I think that net income is very important. Also, and I have the one question: the for investor dividends, how the company can pay the dividend is important, and we must assess that. And when there is no recycling, then that is the you know we as a capital gain loss is in AOCI. And how it moves to retained earnings.
So the retained earnings, I guess, social dividends. I don't think IFRS gives any detail about where in share in equity you classify change OCI. So some companies have accumulated OCI. That's not something IFRS determines, and I think it would be up to a company to determine if it wants to move an amount from if it has an accumulated OCI account into a retained earnings account. There could be an argument for something that's not recycled that it would go to directly to a retained earnings account. There's no direction in IFRS that tells you what capital classification you put it into.
And
And I think that is the major weakness of the IFRS at this point. You couldn't, you know, clearly define or separate retained earnings and accumulated other OCI, because you are not sure whether the recycling was should be, you know, allowed or, you know, prohibited. Actually, at one time, the many board members thought, several years ago, that recycling all should be prohibited. Mm-hmm. Then at that moment, you cannot, you know, or you need not make the distinction. Now you're proposing that you will allow and permit or require the recycling. Then the distinction in between the retained earnings and accumulated other OCI is very important. That should be clearly defined in the conceptual framework, because these two are completely different for us. Retained earnings is there, it's mine, fixed, dividends can be paid. Other accumulated other comprehensive income, that fluctuates. It is supposed to be mine on the balance sheet date, but that is. So these two have this pretty much different information. And therefore, clearly, the definition should be made, and also the clearly the rules of transfer in between from the AOCI to, you know, retained earnings should be specified. In your pension accounting, you didn't do it. You said that up to the jurisdiction, which I think is very irresponsible at that time.
I do understand what you say, and mostly I agree with you. However, the paying dividends largely depends on each jurisdiction's legal framework. And if we articulate what should be distributed, what shouldn't be distributed, that may cause other conflicts with some jurisdictions. I don't know which jurisdictions have what kind of rules. So therefore, that is the reason why we didn't clearly define what is distributable and what is not. So, yes, in the ideal world, and with one accounting standard and with one legal framework, it's possible, but for us, it's very difficult.
Yes, to clarify my point, my emphasis is the distinction in between the within earnings and AOCI is the must thing, the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Then the whether that is, can be paid out as dividend or not is a kind of secondary consideration.
Yes, yes.
Each and every jurisdiction has their own rules, provisions and reserves and things like that. We all understand that. But at least there should be clear distinction. And this distinction I think should be okay to all the countries that I
Just then, Ryozo and Takia for two comments.
Thank you. This is a conceptual framework, so I suppose the approaches taken should be anchored in basic principles, and those principles should be anchored in fundamental purpose of the financial statement. And the approaches presented here, it seems to be not properly anchored in the whole structure. For example, the categories, reading items, mismatch remeasurement, and transitory remeasurement, why these two or three concepts should be the exclusive criteria for OCI? Well, we found two or three notions which can explain the status quo. Okay. But why this should be exclusive criteria? Why these three should be justified? We don't see the explanation. And I think the whole issue should be solved going back to the fundamental principles. The financial statement has purposes, and the statement of financial position has that purpose in one way, and the statement of financial performance serves the purpose in different ways. So they got two roles. We designed the statement of financial performance, state financial position, to best serve that role. Mm-hmm. And then we choose measurement methods for that, etc. Then the periodic change in the financial statement would appear in the comprehensive income. Mm-hmm. But we
assign different role for statement of financial performance, and then define profit and loss to best serve that role. Mm. And if the two coincide, it's okay. But if two differ, we need a briefing item, that is OCI. I think since the ISB has already declared that the profit and loss statement is the primary source of information on financial performance, I think that shouldn't be confined in presentation section. The profit loss is the single most important indicator readers of financial statement usually focus. So just deal that issue by approaches shouldn't be the purpose of the conceptual framework. It should be located and justified in the whole structure, starting from the purpose of the financial system.
I join him in a sense comment that the more from the framework of discussion or the framework of discussion paper viewpoint, I fully understand that the view shown by the Chinese colleague and the our Japanese colleague here, that the word mismatching, breaking, are difficult to understand. This is not because these terms are difficult. Easy, which mismatch, easy. But rather, the way of thinking is difficult to understand. Because on that point, the broad approach, narrow approach, these terms are also difficult to understand. Because you seem to want to define the OCI first, then you want to define the recycling items from the OCI. So you choose the word narrow because you want to recycle the broader items. So that is very difficult to understand. But rather, if you define what kind of information is defined in the profit loss or the financial performance statement, then the OCI or the there is a balance sheet, residual, the comprehensive income. The residual is the other comprehensive income. Of course, we can look at that, but that is residual. So that way of thinking is very intuitively understandable. But when you try to define the OCI first, that would make difficulties to understand. So that is my comment.
I think, you know, we would have tried to do that. We think if profit and loss is the primary measure, you'd hope most things were in there, and as a result, it makes it a very difficult item to define and describe. So therefore, if you think that the smaller number of items are in OCI, it's a more discrete population, so therefore an easier one to define. And we don't want to miss anything. I think we worry if we try to define profit and loss, we might miss something. I'm just conscious.
If you take that way of thinking, I agree with the Olsen's comment that the 2K is the approach by which we should address the profit loss, what should be in the profit loss, so that OCI may be a narrower than that. So if you put it clearly in the discussion paper, the discussion may be more understandable.
Can I ask Jim Paul, I just want to be conscious that we don't miss you out. Is there anything you want to add to that last comment before we move on to lately to assets and liabilities?
Thank you, Christy. Basically, I think completely differently about the whole approach, but I don't see it as a matter of a dichotomy between profit and loss and other comprehensive income. The comprehensive income being something that doesn't exist in the ISB framework presently, so there's a new idea coming in. The very much starting point that I would have is to focus on the entity's economic income in total, and that might be analysed in multiple ways, and indeed Table 8.1 of the discussion paper points out the inherent difficulty of trying to choose a single principle that splits income, however described in Total C, split that into two main categories. And it seems that there's so much stress placed on relevance and predictability, and that's very subjective, and I think there can be almost as many views as there are viewers about what is relevant in a particular period. So I think so much work is being asked of essentially a qualitative characteristic. The framework needs some other principle, and I don't know that you're ever going to find it in a coherent sense. So I would prefer to back away from having a dichotomy and have a multifaceted analysis of performance. So they're my main points. I just also would note that on page 11, the arguments in favour of view one, not to recycle, are what would support. Definitely don't agree with recycling. I don't want to go on any further though because I'm conscious of time.
Thanks, Steve.
Shall we move on to next?
We're running more than 45 minutes late, so I'll try to keep this discussion very short. Again, paper 3, sections 2, 3, 4 of the discussion paper. And we have 5 questions in the paper, but I'd like to discuss it section by section. Starting with section 2, we can put questions 1 and 2. We discuss the definition of assets and liabilities. If you look at paragraph 10 on page 4 of the paper, we do have a chart that shows the existing definition and the suggested definition of the discussion paper. The major change that is suggested is to delete the term expected from the definition, based on the thinking that the term expected might imply a certain threshold that needs to be met to become an asset or a liability. In the interest of time, I'll just open up for discussion.
Do you have any comments?
I'm just thinking that if you look at your table on the chronology source, it defines the proposed definition is a right or other source of value that is capable of producing economic benefits. I stand to be corrected, but I don't think the discussion paper provides further explanation what is economic benefit. I'm just thinking perhaps it will be useful to to explain what the economic benefit is. Why I bring up this point, I thought that observing the EFIC discussion and also IFC discussion on the recent project about the amortization, the appropriate method of amortization, I think terms of what is economic benefit is very important in understanding or in dealing with these issues such as what is the appropriate amortization method.
Any other comments?
We haven't discussed internally in depth yet, but I basically agree that the definition is clarified that there is no threshold included in the definition. However, together with the recognition criteria, in the past we had the threshold for the recognition. As a result of the improvement in the definition, it will broaden the definition of assets and liability too wide. And in the practice, maybe difficult to deal with very detailed issues, detailed assets and liabilities. That's my personal concern. And the other one is that we need to address unit of account somewhere in the asset definition, or maybe together with the measurement. We are internally discussing about that. I understand that you don't think it's necessary to address the unit of account in the conceptual framework rather, but we think it's necessary to address that.
any other comments first before we make reactions? Yes.
We are generally supportive of the definition of assets and liabilities, excluding the notion of expected future cash inflow or outflow, and also retaining the past events. But the one difficulty is the relation between Section 2 and Section 5. In Section 5, you have the narrow equity. That approach is already different from the definition of equity. The equity in Section 2. So we are a little bit attracted by the narrow equity approach. So I would take it as a consideration to take into account.
Okay, so just about unit of account, I think I take your point, and this is one of the most important area of the accounting. However, it's quite difficult to define the general term what the unit of account should be. So therefore, we didn't make an approach in this conceptual framework. However, we welcome comments. What is the proper definition of the unit of account in conceptual basis. One more, you can, sorry. I couldn't see you. Yes, sorry about that.
Just some comment on the assets and liability. Generally, we agree with the definition of the assets and the liability, except that we think the expected should be retained. Because we think some comments from the stakeholders in China, they think if we remove the expected notion, maybe it will result in some difficulties or measurement. And in our opinion, recognition and the measurement are two different steps. In financial reporting, first is definition and then measurement. If you remove the expected notion, maybe it will lead to some difficulty on measurement. For example, in current IFRS, the expected notion plays an important role in many accounting treatments. Mm-hmm. For example, in IAS 37, the provision, if it's probable that litigation will be lost, then a provision will be provided based on the most likely outcome. If the degree of likelihood should not affect recognition but may affect measurement, that means the litigation will be measured using expected value, no matter if probable or not. So maybe other IFRS should be changed. So that's just one example of our concern. So we just recommend that the expected should be retained. Another point is regards to the unit of account. We hope the conceptual framework should address this issue, maybe give some definition or some guidance, something like that. Because in current IFRS, firstly, unit of account is very important, as we know. And another point is that in current IFRS, we have different terms used in this area. For example, in IAS 36, we use cash generating unit, right? Maybe in our opinion, cash generation unit is similar to the unit of account. If yes, could you please provide some clarification or explanation on this.
On a short point, I have a question. So the discussion paper proposes deleting the reference to probability or the possibility from both the definition and the recognition criteria. Would you be comfortable if we take out the term probable or expected from the definition but put in a probability threshold in the recognition criteria? Would that be okay with you? Or do you want it in the definition?
My personal view is okay. That's my personal view.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to move on to question three, which relates to section three of the discussion paper, which discusses additional guidance on the asset liability definition. And in particular, today we want to discuss your views on the obligations that are conditional on the entity's future action. And in page 6 of the paper, or paragraph 14 of the paper, it summarizes the three views that are presented in the discussion paper regarding how we might view when we have a present obligation, or when an entity has a present obligation. I won't go through them in detail, but there are three views presented in the paper, and the IC's tentative position is to reject view one, but does not have a clear view on whether to take two or three. There's another question of whether we, the IC, should determine one of these views. That's another question.
One theoretically may be correct, but may result in omission of liability. View 2, I guess, is closer to the definition of liability. View 3, you heard some actually confused with whether view 3 may be confused with the application of the matching principle, which as all of us know, it's quite, you know, outdated at the moment.
Thank you.
Sorry, the question seems to be more of a question of valuation or measurement rather than the definition. And I would like to ask the background of this treatment. Usually, future actions to avoid the transfer would entail some opportunity costs, like a foregone profit opportunity, etc. And the opportunity cost would differ depending on the future environment. And for example, if environment A happens, the opportunity cost is very high, then the company would choose to transfer the resources. And then in environment B, if the opportunity cost is small, then the entity would take the action and avoid the transfer. Then, so it's a kind of environment contingent future payout question. So maybe it can be treated like a option valuation type of approach. And my question is, why you didn't do that, but rather treated it in the definition part? Thank you.
Yes, there is a question about measurement. That's definitely so. I guess the question is, do we want to wait until the very end until we know all the results and account for that, or that would be probably view one, which is strictly unconditional, or whether we want to recognize liabilities a little bit earlier so to provide useful information to users, although we don't know the exact results about all that sort of things that happened, and the company should account for it. So the question is, how early or what kind of condition needs to be met, even if we know that the entity's action might change the outcome of the eventual cash outflows? And the question is, do we want to be very strict in saying, well, we need to know the exact results and it needs to be finalized, or we might want to measure that line a little bit earlier? There is a question about measuring, and I think it's about how early we want to see it to provide useful information to users, or do we want to give very hard results?
Reading the discussion paper, comparing view 1 through view 3 and examples, we are preliminarily supportive of view 2. However, this paper was issued is fit for the conceptual framework is not here. So we don't know without view 1 and view 3, the view 2 is clear enough. So, or the word practical and conditional could be explainable for various situations. So, we are not so sure this could be fit for the discussion of the context of the work.
Again, it's not discussing legal internally, and I generally agree with the view, the rejection of view 1, and I'm struggling to understand the difference between view 2 and 3. I thought that practical inability in view 2 is maybe similar to the constructive obligation, maybe not, I don't know. And if there is a practical ability to avoid that, then it's not a liability under view 2, right?
If there's a practical ability to avoid, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Then if that is true, then profit or loss in the income statement. Mm-hmm. Will provide the difference between the increase of liabilities in the period, and so if there is a practical ability to avoid that obligation, then it will not be reflected in the performance or profit or loss in that period. I thought,
mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to understand the difference between view 2 and 3, and which is more relevant for the financial reporting.
Let me give you an example for each of these views that are current IFRS, if they do exist. View 1 is that the interpretation on levy is consistent with the view 1. Paragraph in IS 34 that deals with the allocation of variable lease payments, I think, consistent with view 2, and the recognition of pension liability consistent with view 3. So we do have guidance already in IFRS that sort of use these views, and the question is whether we want to make it in one and make it more consistent throughout IFRS, or do we want to do it standard by standard, and if so, which ones we want. And the fact that the board rejected view 1 doesn't necessarily mean that we will change the levy interpretation immediately. Mm-hmm. That's another issue. But we do have existing standards that do use this way of thinking. It's just a way of thinking. I'd like to move on to the last part of the paper 3.
Jim here. I just want to briefly remark that the difficulty I'm having with anything that's not enforceable, enforceable close to view 1, not necessarily exactly the same, but enforceability is the driver in my mind, and once an obligation isn't enforceable presently against the entity, then I don't know how to rule out economic compulsion. So in views 2 and 3, especially view 3, it seems that economic compulsion would become part of the reason why you would identify something as a liability. I know that's not the goal, but I don't know in practical terms how to avoid that. So that's my main concern on that. I just wanted to briefly say.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to the third part of the paper, questions 4 and 5. I'll probably discuss this together. It's about recognition and de-recognition. The board's preliminary view is that an entity should recognize all assets and liabilities under the definition unless providing information on that asset or liability is not relevant or does not a faithful representation of the item. That is the basic view for recognition. And in terms of derecognition, the board's preliminary view is that a control approach is the best in most cases, and we want to use the mirror image of recognition for derecognition for the most part. But if the entity retains control of a component of an asset or liability, the board would determine on a standards level what to do with the recognition and derecognition, the derecognition of the asset or liability. And the paper does propose some ways that we can do that. With that, I'll just open up for a moment.
Regarding recognition, we are supportive of the proposal to eliminate the probability threshold from recognition criteria, because it is an obstacle for derivative recognition. However, I have the same concern with the Chinese colleagues. In many cases, losing the probability threshold, my most concern is several years ago the IS-37 revision, very big confusion took place. So if you just eliminate from the recognition criteria the probability threshold, that may generate such confusion. So somehow, I don't know how, but somehow the notion of probability should be retained. And regarding derecognition, we noticed in this discussion paper, derecognition is not sufficiently described. I think derecognition is quite difficult compared with recognition, because the unit of account may change when it derecognizes, including componentization. So unit of account issue is very difficult. So that means derecognition issue is also difficult. So in the current development of conceptual framework, the most important thing is clearing the profit or loss, no CI. So this process should be done in an early stage. So after finishing the first stage, you may explore the recognition and the units of account issue data.
Thank you. The paragraph 20 says that an entity should recognize all its assets and liabilities unless the ISB decides in a particular standard. It has to me a bit too prescriptive. The current definition of assets and liabilities is so broad
whatever future possibility, however remote, however difficult to measure, however intangible, it's considered as asset and liability. And then, unless the ISB develops a specific standard, all asset and liability has to be recognized. But I think it's almost impossible for ISB to cover every probable assets and liabilities in specific standards. So I think it might be better to use the guiding principles in paragraph 21 through E as a kind of a principle. And the ISB is expected to develop some particular standards based on those guiding principles, but then if there is a situation of no specific rules, I think people should be able to revert back to the principles. Well, of course, as you previously said, the recognition part can incorporate expectation elements, then the issue should be solved. But unless that, maybe paragraph 50 might be
Thank you very much. At least for the liability, the current standard, how it's written, is that IS-37 will catch all liabilities that are not addressed in other standards. So, technically speaking, an entity will never look into the conceptual framework directly because there will be a standard to refer to. Maybe that's not the case for assets, and I think your point is okay.
It's not
really
just a thought. I'm thinking like perhaps for partial relocation situation, perhaps it's important to distinguish whether the person of the retained asset or liability is considered as new asset or liability. Why so? Because it may be helpful then in determining the measurement basis of this retained asset or liability.
I think that's one of the ways to think about the recognition, and I think we haven't really done a thorough analysis of that.
Do you have any other comments on this topic? So.
No, I just wanted to make a general, well, it's a question as much as an observation, and that is that it seems that while derecognition is covered, there is a proposed concept, and that is to use control, that the scope of that principle seems to be fairly limited because question 9 says that the treatment when an entity retains a component of asset or a liability is a standards level issue, and when we look at examples 1 and 2 in paragraphs 4.39 to 4.44, those transactions had discussion of control and risks and rewards without a conclusion. So the impression I got is on the tough issues, the intention of the ISB is to deal with that at standards level only. If that were the case, that would bother me. I think there should be some overarching principles in the framework, albeit that the practical ramifications of that may be standards level, but we need things in the concepts first. In raising that concern, I do want to give a strong message of support for preferring control. Do support that notion.
Thank you.
If there isn't any other questions on this topic, I'd like to move to the general discussion. Actually, today we covered 3 topics, but the conceptual framework provided other issues as well. And in the section 1, we explained the purpose of the conceptual framework. And in current conceptual framework, we showed a lot of purposes. However, our new proposal really concentrates on the ISB's
on providing consistent basis for the ISB to make a new standard. And so that is slightly different from the current conceptual framework. The other thing is about the equity issues, which were mentioned by ICUO. In Section 5, we made a new proposal about the equity. Although the definition of the equity is just the residual, we didn't change that, but instead we said that we will provide some classes of equity, and we are proposing to update some classes of the equity, and that the change should be shown in the statement of equity. So that is a quite new proposal. And the other thing is about the presentation, and we touched upon the what should be presented in the on the face of primary financial statement and what should be presented in the notes. And those are the things we showed in some sections. And also we touched upon some other things about the stewardship and reliability and other competitive issues. And that is the prudence. So we didn't discuss it in the in our conceptual framework, but we touched upon it. So if you have any opinion on these three contentious issues, I would like to welcome your comments. So for any point, I would like to welcome your comments.
Thank you, Ben. Regarding Section 5, equity and liability. We support it of analyzing of the process of equity, but we do not support the update measurement of other classes or other classes of equity. The DT says it shows the wealth transfer between the shareholders. And you have a good example of option holders case. In there, the total equity amount is same, so the option holders' wealth becomes bigger than the common shareholders' amount is reduced. But the wealth transfer does not take place in the economic reality. So that means the option value depends on the common stock value. So common stock value goes up, option value also goes up. So the direction of the wealth goes the same way. Mm. So that means when the wealth of the option holders becomes bigger, that means the common stockholders' wealth also becomes big. So that is very that's not a good treatment in the equity section.
On this point, I have a little bit different view. I do understand the value of the option and the value of the common stock would be the same, and the direction itself is the same. However, the difference between option and the common stock is common stock is already paid once, and the option is the one which you must pay something in future stage. So there is a slight difference. That is why we have a long debate about the difference between liability and equity. And in order for us to finish this long debate, what we are suggesting is we depend on the definition dividing line on the definition of liability, rather narrow definition of that liability, and then residual goes to the equity. But instead, we divide it into two classes. And for the common stock area, that is the real capital. In a sense, I would say narrow equity, which is pure paid-up capital. But the other class is somewhere between equity and liability. So, of course, we could call it mezzanine, but at this moment, we do not call it a mezzanine. But because there are many accounting transactions, we need to make a debit entry and a credit entry. That causes a lot of tension. So therefore, we propose to update some classes. And then that would sort out a lot of problems. That is what we think. But I accept that common stock and option value have the same direction.
Thank you. Just a brief comment on the profit and prudence. I think the proposed definition of the profit is too narrow. This is a concrete framework for the ISB to develop the standards. Why it is now? Just go to any bookstore and pick up any textbook of IFRS. The first chapter is always a conceptual framework. So the conceptual framework is the first constitution under, you know, a moral code, behavioral code, and a guiding star for the preparers to prepare the statement and for us to read the statement. So the everybody should be treated as a pari passa. Not the ISB at the top and we at the below you. And the second thing is about the prudence. The current existing standards omitted prudence, saying that it is in contrast, in contradiction with the neutrality, which is a very plausible argument. Then the question arises that what is neutrality and how can we achieve the neutrality. And even the discussion paper admits that preparers have a natural bias to be too optimistic, and we, the financial statement users, show asymmetric responses to good news and bad news of our country. For example, when a company reverses its provisions and make a profit, we say, oh, fine, congratulations, and that's it. But when a company, you know, keep decognizing assets by impairment, then we say, oh, what the heck are you doing? How much losses are you going to make next year? The stock price is, you know, plunges and too much volatility, unnecessary volatility, that is costly to the macro economy. So because of these things, these two things, I think slightly biased to the conservative is optimal neutrality for financial reporting. In order to secure this, I think the world of prudence should be retained or revived in the conservative framework.
Any other comments?
Maybe on the second point, also mentioned the, about the disclosure or the presentation part. I found that after coming to this post, that in this world, disclosure means disclosure in note, rather than disclosure as a whole. So that is one of the jargon I couldn't understand first. But the, having said that, I read the not read, sorry, but the September's decision made by the board of the ISB that the there may be immaterial items which may obscure the material information, something like that. I forgot the exact wording of that, but I welcome that statement which may direct the discussion on the disclosure in notes, at least. At the same time, I'm wondering, this is the question part. When you said immaterial information, does it mean the immaterial for the certain companies, but that information may be material for the companies?
because all the information stipulated in the standard may be identified as a material information for the some companies at least. So can I understand that in that way? And I welcome that direction, but I want to see more on that point.
On materiality generally? Do you want to see more on materiality in the conceptual framework, or are you happy that the board...
I welcome the direction of discussing the possibility of immaterial information, which could obscure the material information, because people in this world maybe tend to say all the information may be material as far as the standards required, but that is not the case.
On the materiality, I think it's important that we have additional guidance, be it outside the scope, be it in the education guidance material, because I think one of the reasons that has caused excessive checklist or boilerplate type of disclosure perhaps is due to lack of understanding on how to make judgment in assessing materiality for disclosure purposes. For example, how to distinguish judgment of materiality for the purpose of recognition and measurement versus that of for the purpose of disclosure. So, I mean, some form of guidance would be helpful.
So you're suggesting that materiality for recognition and disclosure should be clearly defined?
I think it would be helpful if there is some explanation on the link, whether it is different or, you know, what's the threshold, you know, it doesn't matter, be in the conceptual framework for the education.
So that is a stream or something we're looking at as part of the disclosure initiative, which is outside of the conceptual framework but builds on the concept which we're planning to retain in the conceptual framework of materiality. So the board felt materiality was the concept was clear, but the application might need some help. So that's why it brought out the conceptual framework into a standards level discussion.
Christy, on that particular aspect, it's a little unclear to me how the ultimate work from the disclosure initiative, which of course includes some fairly detailed issues as well, but to the extent to which it creates a disclosure framework to replace IS 1, 7 and 8, and there are principles developed, would you see that as resulting in some conceptual framework, that the wording going into the framework, if they are principles?
It's a good point. We are working in parallel at the moment, so as we develop the conceptual framework, we're also doing research to how we might address what we're calling, you know, the replacement of IS1, IS7 and IS8. So we would hope that there'd be sort of a crossover. It's a good point whether what we deal with specifically on disclosures within the IS1 would be so conceptual or principles based that we felt it was better belonging in the conceptual framework. I hope that we get the cut right, but it might be something we need to be very careful on as we're sort of running this parallel discussion. But I think that's the benefit of doing it in parallel.
You said in the presentation you are trying to have the some idea of the subtotal of the profit in P&L or if it is part in the standard.
In the disclosure initiative, last week we took a paper to the board about totals and subtotals. There was a mention that should we acknowledge totals, for example, commonly used ones like EBIT or EBITDA in IS1. The board was of the view that we should not acknowledge in particular.
Through the European companies, partner with the Portland, then the data actually countries are limited. But they start their own basis, so we cannot compare it. So actually, the income is important, but also liquidity is very important. So I think now you step forward.
We did not support to put acknowledged EBIT or EBIT does it. But what we did, the board did agree to do was to provide some guidance in IS1, which deals with when you require a subtotal or total in the primary financial statement, to put some sort of guidance which may discipline how that's described and how consistent it should be. So that's what we would do.
Actually, the companies and also investors are already doing that. So I think now it must do with the setting standards for the definition, which definition, how we calculate it.
Yes, and some Japanese analysts want to have information on the notes, not on the statements, but on the notes, kind of the information that helps us to calculate the EBITDA, so that everybody can use the same basis number.
Yeah, actually, we discussed it last week. So actually, IS1 do not really prohibit to make such a calculation, and rather IS1 requires you to do that if that information is necessary, if that information is inevitable for you to make your financial statement understandable. However, thing is, there are lots of variation of EBITDA or such kind of indication. So that's why auditors are very cautious to put it on the financial statement. That causes a lot of tension. And everybody says EBITDA and everything else are what we call non-GAAP measurement. However, there are some data which consists of GAAP measurement. So that should be allowed, and that could be used in the financial statement. We would like to make clear it, but that is not in the conceptual framework project, but it's a narrow scope. It's a narrow scope amendment for IS1. So, and we would like to provide some exposure draft within next year.
Yes, we want to get that out in Q1 next year.
Is there any other comments? Yes.
Just a few comments. First is related to the reliability. In China, stakeholders prefer reliability rather than the official representation. This is the first comment. Another is about the stewardship, as I just mentioned. And I found that in the basic four conclusion of the revised conceptual framework, one of the reasons that you remove the stewardship is that it's difficult to translate into other language. Actually, I think the stewardship or accountability, they have a long history in accounting. So in Chinese language, we didn't see any difficulty in translation. So our suggestion is please reintroduce the stewardship and the reliability in the conceptual framework. And in addition, we do want to see some many new terms created in the conceptual work, such as the bridge items, the mismatch, the method, something like that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your comments. And I think this round table was really, really useful for us. Especially, I remember the comment from Seiichi, ISD should work harder to distinguish what is the performance and what is not performance. So, and also, we learned quite a lot about stewardship and also
we had a good suggestion about measurements from everyday and on credit issue, and also we had good advice about equity and foreign currency. We should deal with it in some place, perhaps. And those are the very good advice. And also, we had a good suggestion about definition of net profit. So we take all these suggestions into consideration. Thank you very much for today.
Thank you, Tag, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Limbaugh. Thank you for your participation from Australia.
Thank you very much.
Good day.